Chapter 6. Terror, the Imperial Palace. On the feast day of deliverance, it was traditional for the Senatorum Imperialis to restrict its meetings to the Imperium's most urgent business. The Imperial Palace was lifted by evensong. Blessed incense was burned by the brazier, and both Adeptus Custodes and Astartes attendants were required to adopt ceremonial attire. The cavernous halls and corridors of the palace were decked with reverential tapestries, and flocks of winged cherubim read from endless scrolls the lists of fallen notables and petitionaries. Prayers and benedictions were offered, and armies of planetary ambassadors admitted in rotating attendances to witness ritual silences, followed by volley shots and a salute issued by honor guards of decorated Lucifer blacks. Beyond the urgent business of their own mighty bureaucracies, the High Lords of Terra were occasionally called to order during the solemnities and celebrations. The Samarkand hive plague had necessitated such measures, as had the mutiny at Syracuse. Since the Adamantian atrocity, the tedium of unscheduled council meetings had become a common distraction for the Senatorium Imperialis. Today's urgent business regarded the loss of the shrine worlds of the Geronimus Fyodora cluster and that glittering jewel of piety, the cardinal world of Fleur de Fides. Most days there were reports of some kind of distant disaster. It had become almost commonplace. Such news, if reported publicly, would have thrown Terra's billions into a state of panic and mobilized thousands of interest groups and influentials. It was agreed that this was not in the best interests of the Imperium. Instead, the horror of such catastrophes was restricted to the staid and stuffy assemblages of the High Lords, informal meetings of the 12, in which the great and good of Terra put such tragedies in context. A great tragedy indeed. I believe my confessor attended the College Cathedra at Fleur de Fides. A beautiful world, a real loss to the Imperium. Cardinal Creutzfeldt will be looking for another seat, I suppose. Isn't Gilbertia part of the Fyodora cluster? No, wait, I'm thinking of the Outer Trinities. Dreadful business. Loss of life, calculated by the billion, put unnecessary strain on the mind of the common Imperial citizen. The destruction of worlds, sometimes a score at a time, stoked patriotic notions of galacticism, and the suspicion that humanity was losing its grip of its precious empire among the stars. The 12 men and women gathered in the Anisidoran chapel did not deal in such sentimentalities. They were perpetually lost in a blizzard of decisions, quantifications, and bureaucracy, in which the considerations of bounty and starvation, war and peace, life and death, were measured by planet, by subsector, and segmentum. In a galactic game with an unimaginable number of pieces in play, it wasn't difficult for even the greatest minds and keenest ambitions of the Senatorum to become desensitized to the importance of individual details. Indeed, over time, even the most experienced of players tended to become blind to the board for the profusion of pieces. Within a parliament of such minds, even minor problems became exacerbated. In the kingdom of the deaf, dumb and blind, problems with small beginnings, small at least on a galactic scale, had a way of gathering irresistible momentum. From their own legions of aides and overseers, the great lords of Terra would have fragments of the same story. Some might have glimpsed certain characters amongst a greater cast, some a significant twist of the plot or timely reveal, nonsensical without knowledge of the events leading up to it. Some might even have a narrative of doom laid before them, but not know it. A tale with all the important words removed, a close exercise in fate, a puzzle of the calamity to come. What none of them had was the most essential feature of the story. The end. Juskina Tull had colluded with her Chartist captains to raise the price of passage and transportation between the Segmentum Core and the Rimward sectors, but had not foreseen the decimation of her freighter fleets and the severance of ancient trade routes. Fleur de Fides was a spiritual beacon in the darkness of the Outer Rim, to be sure. The Martian Kubik, fabricator general and vox piece for the cult Mechanicus, had his own empire to look to. Can a man, Even an augmeticized transhuman served two masters and served them both equally. Kubik seemed to spend most of his time aboard his consular barge, moving between ancient Terra and the Red Planet. But in the cold corridors of his mechanical heart, Kubik answered only to the Omnisire. During the Great Heresy, the two planets had been at war. The heresy was long over, and a cult confederacy, as strong as it was uneasy, had been re-established. As Fabricator General, it was Kubik's faithful duty to serve the logic of the Machine God. Today, that logic dictated an alliance of mutual benefit. It did not preclude the action of respectful partners in their own interest. Never again would mighty Mars serve as the battered barbican to Fortress Terra. Kubik would see the Red Planet protected, and its empire remain strong and ruthlessly efficient. It was because of this that the Fabricator General had been made aware of the gateway threat of the Xenos Chromes. Ruthless efficiency had secretly fed the Inquisition the selected data required to justify a critical situation packet, despite the fact that Kubik himself then had to denounce its credibility for political advantage. Ruthless efficiency had placed the gifted Magos Phaeton Laurentis with the Imperial Fists on Adamantua, after the bombastic chapter master Cassus Mirren predictably took up the cause. Ruthless efficiency would see the Mechanicus through a disaster that Kubik's legion of logisticians had told him was inevitable. Ruthless efficiency would ensure that only the Machine God's servants had the very best quality data and that the Martian Empire would survive the coming storm. Fleur de Fides was second only to Serenitrix in its global devotions. Is seat Serenitrix open?
Serenitrix would be a good fit for Cardinal Creutzfeldt.
Kubik exchanged programmed pleasantries with a freakish Sark and Anwar. Volquan Sark and Abdullius Anwar, masters of the Astronomicon and Adeptus Astra Telepathica, respectively, were among the Imperium's most powerful psychers. They were all but beings of a different plane. With Helad Gibran, paternoval envoy of the Navigator families, they had helped weave the intricate web of immaterial translation routes and astro-telepathic conduits that overlaid the Imperium corporeal. Without their imperial dominion and supporting networks, the Imperium would grind to a halt like a rust-fused piece of ancient machinery. If they hadn't been so invested in seeking greater representation and influence for their mutant interests, they might have come to comprehend the ragged holes in their gossamer meshwork. They might have seen the speed at which the delicate fabric of the Imperium would unravel with the slaughter of their psychic servants across the Rimwood sectors. They might have understood the unscheduled disruption suffered by their dour League of Black Ships and the voracious hunger of an Astronomicon sustaining emperor. The Grand Provost Marshal looked on. Werner Zech was a hulk of a man, although half of his bulk was made up of augmetic prosthetics. His skin grafting and bionics were evidence of a lifetime spent working city hives of iniquity on Macromunda, and working up through the ranks of the Adeptus Arbites, enforcing, hunting, and judging corruption in the hearts of lesser men. His square jaw betrayed disinterest, whatever he forced his eyes to suggest, and in doing so, Zech revealed the very nature of his calling. The Provost Marshal could track a consignment of narcotics up through the hive down to its very last grain. He could beat confessions from mutants, spire nobles, and even fellow arbitrators in precinct house dungeons. He could preside over courts for months, sometimes years at a time, passing judgment on sector-spanning criminal enterprises so involved and complex that they would burn out a calculus logi's cogitator. But among the ancients of the Senatorum, blinded by tedium of the most intense kind, Zech found that his nose for criminality and corruption abandoned him. The occasional sniffs of malfeasance, suspected abuses, secrets of self-interest, profiteering, were ignored by the Grand Provost Marshal. Like a cyber mastiff before a river or a sewer channel of effluent, Zech lost the scent, his suspicions carried off by a stream of banal bureaucracy. Perhaps a donation of some kind would be in order.
For the greater palatial families?
Or for the palatials, yes. The Lord Commander and Eckhart, the master of the Administratum, were guiltier than most of inaction. If the Imperium were a ship, buffeted in a sea of circumstance, at the mercy of galactic chance, then information was its anchor. With an Imperium of information at their augmented fingertips, or at the fingertips of a chancellor, archivist, clerk, or scribe who occupied posts on the bottomless data chain below them, Eckhart and Lord Commander Udo had the knowledge required to solve all but the most dire of the Imperium's problems, or those that were to come. The abyssal infotombs of the Estate Imperium, the Tithes Chamber Notarium, the Ordozarchy of the Departamento Munitorum, the findings of inquiries and inquiries about inquiries gathered in Vellum Mountains at the Officio Officium, decades of backdated threat assessments from the Logis Strategos and Vermilion-class strategic directives, Solar, Obscurus, Pacificus, Tempestus, Ultima, and Extra Galaxia. These were but a few of the Byzantine institutions and divisions that answered to Eckhart and Udo's absolute authority. It wasn't as though the pair were not aware of the Adamantian atrocity. Even before the catastrophe, the Inquisition had brought the situation to Udo as part of a critical situation packet. Eckhart was already well aware of the Xenos species known as the Chromes in the form of the damage their encroachment was doing. Missed tithes and trade disruptions. After Adamantua, as one Xenos threat was exchanged for another, little change for Eckhart and the Lord Commander. The Orcs had always been a threat. The Lord High Admiral's fleets were engaged in actions on the frontier space of the Imperium, defending worlds and trade routes from junkers, freebooting greenskins, and upstart warlords declaring wars from warp-spewed space hulks. Indeed, beyond being dropped into such internecine border wars with the Greenskins, Veriolt, the new Lord Commander Militant of the Astra Militarum, had inherited the Emperor's Bastion amongst the stars, only to find it already thoroughly committed to crusades and long-standing strategic engagements. Qual Swarmhood expansions, a segmentum solar grazing Hrud migration, expeditionary fleets from the Nadirax Republic, coreward appearances of the aggressive Beeltan craft world, carnivorous transplants mounting seed invasions of imperial systems surrounding the Nepenthes death world, Tyrellian mercenary movements in the Fidas sector, the Kindred, the Zerontian Similisworn, the horrific resurgence of the Ubergast. Data continued to flood in from the various theatres, and while Abel Veriolt was eager that all threats receive due attention, troops and material, response times were glacial. The Lord Commander Militant was often working with reports that were months out of date. Troop movements arrived to find Xenos threats long eradicated. Some simply disappeared into the embrace of alien forces that had grown many times in magnitude since their deployment. Others found themselves sent astronomical distances to incorrect coordinates, finding nothing but dead space, wasted opportunity, and relief in equal measure. While some would later deem the Lord Commander Militant's inexperience in both the galactic theatre and the daedal politics of the Imperial Palace a factor in a catastrophe both unfolding and unappreciated, others would lay responsibility at the doors of the Lords Udo and Eckhart. Only they truly had the pieces of the puzzle in their hands. Their blindness came not of inexperience, but of veteran pedantry. Amongst the dire threats already presented to the Imperium, the myriad planetary tragedies and enemies innumerable, the evolving calamity heralded by the Adamantian atrocity, was but one atrocity among many.
A toast to Beta Novax. Fleur de Fides. Beta Novax was yesterday. To Fleur de Fides, then.
Resplendent in navy dress uniform, Admiral Lansung was bold and broad. His jacket was the blue of the deepest oceans, and the golden waterfalls of his epaulettes tumbled from his thick shoulders. He parted the gathering like a capital ship on manoeuvres before joining Lord Commander Udo and Eckhart at the Ecclesiarch's altar. Freighters moved through the group of significance, handing out fortified amasek and attending to the gathering's petty conveniences. One by one, the 12 approached the Anisidron altar, where Ecclesiarch Mesring delivered a blessing. Dipping his chubby digits into the ash of incense, Mesring used his thumb and finger to smear an aquila on the foreheads of the presented worthies. About them, the wolfish Venand circled. She had respectfully left her bodyguard at the chapel archway, and now she watched and drifted, her eyes narrowing sharply beneath her precisely cropped fringe. She absently took a glass of Amasek from a passing freighter and exchanged greetings with the Paternoval envoy, Helad Gibran, without looking. Venand went through the motions. She drank in celebration of the feast day. She took her blessing. She bore her soot sigil. All the time, the Inquisitor was watching, thinking, reaching determination. The Imperium was ailing and vulnerable to attack. The great men and women of the Imperium before her had grown like a cancer about their responsibilities. The Inquisition was the cure. They would surgically trim the tumorous lethargy and self-interest from the hallowed halls of the Imperial Palace in order to save the body politic. Strategies were in play. Pressure was being directed. Wheels turned within wheels, taking the Imperium in the right direction. She looked up at the stained glass representation of the God Emperor behind Mesring and the attendant savant priests that never left his side. It was her job, her sacrosanct duty, to further the Inquisition's myriad interventions and keep the Imperium on the right track. She despised surprises. She prided herself on being the most informed personage in the chamber, and wished to remain that way. Surprises had a horrible way of manifesting in such meetings, however. In meetings of the Senatorum, and of course the meetings of members' agents in the darkness of hive basement sections and underlevels. Venand was still breaking in Raznik, her new bodyguard. Her former escort operative's smashed body had been discovered in the bowels of a Tashkent maglev terminal. He had underestimated his quarry. It had served as a useful reminder to Venand not to underestimate hers. Her predacious movements were not lost on another of the chapel's predators. As Mesring's priests and freighters fell to prayer and the Ecclesiarch joined the rest of the 12, he was met with commiserations and faux concern over the loss of the shrine worlds of the Geronimus Fyodora cluster and the cardinal world of Mesring's own ordination, Fleur de Fides. Some dangers, like the unfolding greenskin crisis in the Rimwood sectors, were obvious. Some dangers liked to remain hidden. Some hid in plain sight. One thing was certain. The Anisidoran chapel of the Imperial Palace, clouded with the lethal ambitions of both predators and prey, was one of the most dangerous places in the galaxy.